Hello everyone and welcome to this new episode of The Burning Case. Have you ever seen those ads for Total, Shell or BP bragging about their climate commitments? Usually it includes some forest or solar panels in the background and thought, what the hell am I looking at and how can they be so shameless? Because I have. And the worst part is that those campaigns are not only designed and developed to influence you and I to think these guys are doing a good job. As a reminder, 3/4 of global emissions come from the energy sector. They're also targeting policymakers, the very people that, you know, in an ideal world where we all followed science recommendations, would ban all new fossil fuel developments and take measures now to transition towards renewable energy, are often the targets of carefully crafted campaigns developed by creative agencies that nobody knows about and who are hired by polluting industries to make themselves look great. So that is very, very uncool, and that is what we'll be discussing today, taking another trip behind the scenes of why we are still very much facing a climate emergency and who's responsible for that. So to discuss this, I am very happy to welcome Duncan Maisel, who is joining us from the US and who is the director of Clean Creatives. Hi, Duncan. How are you doing? Can you tell us a bit more about who you are?
Yeah, thank you so much for that introduction. You actually really nailed the summary of the campaign so well. Yeah, I'm the director of Clean Creatives, which is a project that's bringing together leading advertising and public relations agencies and practitioners to end their industry's work with fossil fuel companies. And we started Clean Creatives, my co-founder Jamie and I, in 2020, a little over a year ago, because we had, in the past, we worked as, you know, in the climate movement, doing communications for big marches or for the divestment movement or to stop pipelines. And we always found that every time we would try and do something good, there would be these really well-funded, well-run PR and ad campaigns to encourage policymakers to do something bad. And it's really clear that advertising and public relations is a critical piece of the way that the fossil fuel industry upholds its political power and its social license. And what we found talking to people in the advertising and public relations industry is that, for the most part, the people who work in that industry don't think that fossil fuel companies reflect their values or embody the kind of work that they want to do. And so we've had a really productive conversation and dialogue with leaders in the industry about how to end this kind of work, because it is so misleading and so dangerous. And as of today, there's over 200 agencies that have taken our pledge to not take future contracts with fossil fuel companies or their friend groups.
So for those who maybe don't know who exactly, which type of organizations we are talking about here, can you maybe explain what is a creative agency? Who are we talking about? What is its role? How do they get approached by clients for which type of work? Because we often hear consultancies, but a lot of people don't necessarily know what a creative agency does. You know, what type of jobs do they do for the clients? Can you maybe explain a little bit?
Yeah. So to take a specific example, like the CEO of Exxon, for instance, is not an advertising expert. You know, they're someone who's worked in oil fields or oil science or geology or something like that. And so Exxon's message that they bring to the public is crafted by people they have specifically hired to focus on how to persuade the public to support Exxon's agenda. And those are creative agencies or public relations agencies. And what those agencies do is that they're teams of specialists that are really good at crafting the messages that you see in basically all kinds of advertisements. They usually work across a broad portfolio of clients, whether it's consumer packaged goods or auto manufacturers or, you know, furniture or whatever. So, you know, it's really a group of experts who have, you know, honed the skills of influencing the public, and oil companies or their front groups or their trade associations, you know, put out requests for proposals, and they ask those agencies to pitch them on saying, you know, here's the work we'll do for what cost and the kind of work that they'll do and the kind of, you know, ways that they're going to persuade the public. So it's really, these agencies are people who are really good at speaking to the public. And, you know, I have worked in climate communications for a long time now with movements. And, you know, they are really great at what they do. Like speaking with people who are in the ad companies, like they're fantastic. It's like it's a genuine skill. And so when you think about the role that they can play in addressing climate change, it's kind of a superpower. And it's a superpower you can use for either good or evil. And so we're trying to really move them in the direction of using it for good.
Yeah, too bad they're using that superpower for the wrong people at the moment. But okay, so creative people, but is it the same or can it be the same in some cases? Do some agencies do that, but also public affairs, as in influencing policymakers? Because I feel, at least in Brussels, sometimes some organizations that present themselves as kind of creative agencies, they also have those teams of public affairs officials that follow the policymaking process and that are able to also influence using those super creative people and creative techniques and craft the message crafting, etc. Not only influence the public, but also influence the policymakers. Can sometimes the line be a bit blurry between these two?
Yeah, I'd say the line is very blurry. I think that a lot of the decisions about what messages to bring to the public and then are made in the same rooms where people decide what message to bring to policymakers. It's something that is done in sync. And so, for instance, like, in 2020 here in the US, the same week that Joe Biden announced what his climate policy would be during the 2020 election, you could see spending by oil companies, by the American Petroleum Institute, by Exxon, by Chevron go up massively on Facebook. Like they just began to really flood the zone. And what they were doing is they were responding to that policy question about like, what are we going to do about climate change? And then deciding at that point, okay, we need to persuade the public to do X or Y. And so you can see that's kind of a good example of how the line is very blurry and a lot of those decisions are made in the same room, if not by the same people.
Yeah, absolutely. And that is, of course, extremely problematic. And why is the role of these companies problematic in a context like the climate crisis? Is it because they're helping them spreading misinformation? Is it because they're helping them spinning the commitments to something that is not the reality?
Well, the problem is, I would say, twofold. You know, when you look at it, here's the way I put it. Fossil fuel companies are the world's biggest polluters, and they are the world's biggest greenwashers. They spend most of their money misleading the public about what their commitments are, because if they said what they were actually doing, they would have very, very little public support and very little support in, halls of power by decision makers. You know, if you look at the actual spending priorities of major oil companies, it's around 99% of what they are doing is drilling for more oil and gas. That is what they spend their time and money on. Yeah. And so, you look at their advertisements, it's a very different percentage of their ads actually feature oil and gas. And so what you're getting is a really misleading image of what these companies are trying to do. And that misleading image is then trickles down to, you know, what the public supports and how urgently the public thinks the action needs to be taken. And sometimes it's, you know, in the form of, you know, misleading characterizations of what these companies are trying to do to address climate change. You know, I should be clear that it's not, you know, advertisements saying climate change isn't real, don't worry, keep burning gas. A lot of the times it's saying, you know, we really are interested in solving this. And, you know, maybe in 20 years, we'll be able to remove, you know, 10% of the carbon dioxide that we produce from the atmosphere or something like that. You know, it's stuff that, if you didn't really understand the specifics of how big these companies are, how much they pollute, it's very easy to get a misleading picture of how much they support climate action.
Yeah. So it's greenwashing 101, right? It's focusing on the 2% or 3% investment that they are actually putting into renewable energy, or it's emphasizing the so-called research that they are doing to remove carbon from the atmosphere. It's like all these little elements that make people think that they're actually doing a good job when really they're still the biggest polluters on the planet, right?
Precisely. Yeah. I mean, they sort of pick out these specific examples, bring them wildly out of context, or just use like really kind of, I don't know, sneaky language. You know, they one of the things that Shell says often is that they have a net zero ambition or a net zero aim or something like that. And that's not a commitment. That's saying we would like to be net zero at some point. But then if you sort of read the fine print on Shell's website, they say Shell's operating plans and budgets do not reflect our net zero target. And so it's this use of language that is deceptive, and very clearly they see a threat to their business model here from people recognizing what they're actually doing. And so they don't tell you about it.
And how widespread is that problem? How many of the biggest agencies, the most famous agencies that are usually, you know, multinational companies, some of the names that are the most famous in the US are also very famous here in Brussels or at the national level in Europe and even some other parts of the world. How much of a problem is it, you know, taking fossil fuel companies as clients and, you know, working with them to kind of spin their commitments and potentially spreading greenwashing and misinformation?
In September, we released a list, the F List, which was a report on the known relationship that we could identify connecting fossil fuel companies to specific agencies. And we found at least 90 different agencies, many of them large, that had these relationships. And there's probably more. You know, a lot of these relationships are, I don't know if secret is the right word, but they're not public. You know, they're not something that the agencies themselves advertise, like, oh yes, we work with BP now. So it's widespread. And like you said, it's in some of the biggest companies that work in this area. So, you know, the world's largest advertising holding company is called WPP. They work extensively with BP and Chevron and others. And, you know, they brag that, you know, a gigantic percentage, like, of the world's messages that go out over the internet are touched in some way by WPP agencies. And so when you think about the kind of reach that these multi-billion dollar companies can have, for good or bad, it's an enormous source of legitimacy and power. And so, yeah, it's widespread. And I think that the big companies in particular are going to have to take a hard look at this, because if you think about it, if you're in the side of, you know, let's take a company like GM. GM for a long time has been a climate bad guy. You know, they are not excited about climate action, but they have pledged that they want to sell 100% electric vehicles by 2035. So is VW. So has, I guess it's called Stellantis now, the global, you know, that used to be Chrysler and Fiat and a couple others. A lot of the auto producers in the world have pledged they want to produce 100% electric vehicles. To get that to happen, you need policy changes. You need regulators to make it possible and affordable. And to create incentives in the same way that they incentivize now fossil fuel development. And if you are a major ad agency, you have to be looking at your client list and say, okay, I have Shell, I have BP, they want these policy outcomes. GM, Stellantis, VW, they want a totally different set of policy outcomes. Which side am I on? Which of these clients would I rather work for? And, you know, that's just one very narrow example, but that it happens across all kinds of things. You know, if industry leaders in consumer packaged goods or furniture or electronics or even, you know, social networks and the big tech companies, if they want to clean up their act, they need policy change. And the fossil fuel companies are going to fight that every step of the way. And I think if you're an ad agency, a major agency or a PR agency, you can look at your client list and say, I have to make a choice here. And it should be really obvious which of those clients is, I don't know, more fun, more exciting, more,
more moral
to work on. More moral. Yeah. Geez.
Yeah. No, of course. But speaking of big companies and some of the leaders in the sector, etc., can we talk about Edelman and the campaign that you have ongoing against them. Because, I mean, so Edelman, it's so interesting because when you look at their website and the Brussels office, for instance, even though it's one of the biggest PR ad company, they're so discreet. There's literally three paragraphs that explains the work that they're doing, for instance, at European level. I know they're global, but it literally just says, today, Edelman Brussels offers insights, expertise, and quality in all of our client services with focus not only on Brussels. Our heart lies in public affairs, while our range spans corporate communication, coalition building, and media relation through to research, consumer marketing, executive positioning, and event management. So essentially, they do everything you want them to do. But can you talk a bit about the campaign that, yeah, you have going against them? Like, why them? What are you asking them to do? Who's supporting this campaign?
Yeah. So Edelman is the world's largest public relations firm, and they're privately held. The person who makes all the decisions is CEO Richard Edelman. He owns the company. He runs the company. And what we found when we did our report is that Edelman does more work for fossil fuel companies than any other agency on the planet. And in particular, we had actually found specific detail about the work they were doing for Exxon that had not been disclosed before, just because we found a little stray piece of code on their website that sort of revealed something that they had not made public before. And when that happened in September, at the same time, Edelman was working on a campaign with one of their clients, Tazo Tea Brands, which is a Unilever brand. And they were engaging a number of influencers to talk about Tazo's climate justice priorities, which on their own, I will say, are pretty good. Like, Tazo's plan is actually decent. And they're working with great partners in a lot of places. But at the same time that Edelman was working on that priority, they were working with companies or with front groups like the American Fuel and Petrochemical Manufacturers that were creating the pollution in the environmental justice communities that Tazo was trying to clean up. And so we pointed this out, specifically the Exxon thing and the AFPM relationship. We reached out to some of the influencers that Edelman was working with on that Tazo campaign. And we just asked them, we said, we want to make sure you see this information. If you have a chance to bring it up with Edelman, we think it can make a really a big impact on their thinking about this project. And so they did, and they started having dialogue with them, and they were really unhappy with the dialogue they received from Edelman. It was really not a lot of willingness to change, not a lot of willingness to consider the impacts of working for big polluters. And so those influencers got together and they wrote a public letter and they started inviting other influencers and educators. And you know, in particular, the group that really kind of anchored it was this group of educators called Slow Factory. And they held that dialogue with Edelman. They put together the letter. They did a lot of the design work to bring it together. And you know, Slow Factory has a great reach, and they brought together a huge list of people, along with another educator and activist, Ayanna Johnson, who's also amazing. And so they brought that together. They made this huge pitch to their list of networks, and you know, then during the Glasgow climate talks, they released this public letter asking Edelman to drop Exxon. And so it connected with a huge number of people, actors, influencers, educators, activists, and it made a big splash. And now Edelman has announced that they are going to do a 60-day review of their clients to decide whether or not they're in line with what they see as, you know, useful climate ambition. Now, in the past, Edelman has made these kinds of reviews. That a long time ago in 2015, they said that they were going to stop working for climate deniers. And that's clearly not true.
Yeah.
That there's, you know, so I'm not sure exactly we could trust them on this, but it is a sign that this kind of pressure really works. And I think that there's going to be ongoing pressure on Edelman, not just from us, but from, you know, their clients, from people who have real climate ambition. Like Unilever mm-hmm. has genuine climate policies that are interesting and transformative and important. And just, you know, I have to wonder if it makes sense for a company like Unilever to continue working with a company like Edelman that is so deeply bought in to the fossil fuel agenda.
Mm. So what are the odds you think of Edelman actually dropping Exxon? Do you think it's possible, or do you think I mean, they're claiming that they're reviewing the client list, but as you said, they've done it in the past. And maybe it's just to kind of calm down the people that signed the letter or the people that are sharing the letter. Or do you think there's a genuine chance that they could actually drop them?
I think there's a chance because the world we're living in now is very different from the last time that they had this controversy. You know, the world, the climate policy world of 2021 is just different than it was in 2015. And it was really disappointing to see actually that, you know, Richard Edelman, as he made this announcement about their policy review, said how disappointed he was in the outcomes of the Glasgow climate talks. And really, a lot of the reason that it was going poorly was because of him, because, you know, he helped Exxon run this ad campaign to delay and water down climate policy in the United States.
No shame.
It was just, it's just like, I don't understand that lack of perspective. So yeah, that I don't know what the chances are because I don't know Richard Edelman. I, you know, he said that he is, wants to build a company that's founded on the principle of building trust. And I think that would require a really transparent review. And I think a transparent review that is grounded in the most accurate, the most recent climate science would say there's no room for new fossil fuel development. And it's time to drop these clients. So that's my hope. But I think, you know, past results don't necessarily indicate great future outcomes.
But what about the EU? Like, if we take a closer look of what's happening here in Brussels, because this is what we also try to do with the podcast, is try to mainstream notably EU politics and the link between politics and the most pressing issues of our time, such as the climate crisis. And it's interesting because one of our episodes that got the most listen and the most feedback was one on unraveling lobbying. Like, how does lobbying happen in Brussels? Because I don't know if you know, but Brussels is actually the second city in the world with the most lobbyists, the first one being Washington, D.C. So we're only second to Washington. So there's a lot of things that is happening behind the scenes in order to influence the policymaking process. And a lot of the agencies that are listed on the F list that you mentioned are also present here in Brussels. And by being present in Brussels, a lot of the work they do is indeed kind of targeting policymakers, because this is what the Brussels office usually does. So do you have an example of the role that the creative industry has here in Brussels in trying to influence climate action, for instance?
Yeah, so this is it's a huge deal. And I think that there's a lot of money and energy going into lobbying in the EU because the EU is actually making policy decisions about what to do and has been somewhat more proactive than other governments when it comes to addressing climate policy. So there's kind of more work to do for these polluting industries in a place like Brussels than other countries or other regions where there's less ambition. So one thing that we've been keeping our eye on is this agency called FTI. And FTI is actually a consultancy that has a lot of different arms, but they've really sort of built a sort of cottage industry. I don't know if that's just a US term or not, but they really focused on building a niche for themselves in EU lobbying. And in particular, what they do is they build fake front groups, kind of what we call AstroTurf, sort of fake grassroots. And so a big thing that FTI is focused on right now is hydrogen and rules that have to do with what ways that countries and regions will use hydrogen as an energy source or energy storage, really, I should say, in the future. And so FTI, we know, is built at least two different front groups called Hydrogen Europe and Hydrogen Council. You know, FTI's history is pretty dirty. They do a lot of attacking journalism, attacking activists, and then building these kind of fake front groups. And so there's hundreds of organizations, mostly across oil and gas, that have joined these front groups, Hydrogen Europe and Hydrogen Council. And what they're trying to do is sort of, you know, make what sounds like objective, serious policymaking frameworks for thinking about hydrogen. So they'll write draft legislation, for instance, and say this is backed by, you know, Hydrogen Europe, you know, an industry organization of hydrogen producers. When in reality, what that law will be something that's essentially crafted by oil and gas lobbyists to extend their business. And so the thing about hydrogen is that 95% of hydrogen that's produced right now comes from oil and gas sources. It's still pretty much just a dirty energy system. And so 5% is coming from green. And the idea of hydrogen is people treat as a really green priority, as a green idea. But there's a lot of money to be made or lost in determining how that is created and sourced. And that's really what's at play here. And so FTI is investing a lot of time and money in building these front groups, these grassroots, or sorry, AstroTurf organizations that are meant to provide a sort of sense of objectivity and seriousness to what amounts to just a bunch of fossil fuel priorities, you know, hopefully being put into law.
Wow. Yeah, another look behind the scenes of what's happening here in Brussels. And FTI, as you said, isn't the only one. When I was looking at the F list of companies that have these relationship with fossil fuel companies, so many of them meant something or rang a bell for me and for a lot of people, I'm sure, who work here in Brussels in advocacy. So I would strongly suggest anyone who's listening to take a look at this list, because it's really an eye-opener. And I mean, here we're talking about the fossil fuel industry, but a lot of these companies are also working for extremely polluting companies that are not necessarily fossil fuel. It can be anything from, you know, plastic to fast fashion to tech companies. And it's really, really important the role that they have in influencing policymaking. I guess I had a kind of almost final question is, for a young person who is trying to get into the creative industry and who feels that, you know, kind of these companies would represent a great experience because obviously they're known, they have really famous global clients, and it's a good experience to work in some of these companies, but that still does not want to compromise their values, because this is the case for more and more young people that are entering the workforce. What would you kind of suggest to do instead? Or, yeah.
I think the key is to keep raising the question. In those interviews, ask, you know, do you work with fossil fuel clients? And just be really straightforward about your priorities and your preferences in this, because the creative industry really needs young talent. I mean, they all recognize that there's an almost unlimited number of ways that a creative person could express themselves and make a living now. And so raising the question, saying it's a priority for you, doing that persistence thing really matters. And I think when they hear that from people they're trying to hire or would like to work with, it makes an impact. And that's what I think was so persuasive about the letter from creators and around Edelman, was that they recognize that to do their best work, they need to work with influencers and educators and creators. And so when those people raise their voice and just say, this is a priority for me, you know, that letter didn't say, we're never going to work with you. It wasn't like, you know, please never call us. It was like, do this now. Like, this is huge for us. Just raising that and identifying the problem and identifying that there is a solution means a lot. So I find that really to be the best option, is to just keep raising it. You know, the thing we say about this campaign often is just more is more. The more opportunities you have to bring it up, the better. So yeah, make your voice heard in this. Like, it's something that is a really active dialogue within the industry. You won't be shocking anybody by bringing it up. And it will be a way to just advance the conversation. Because honestly, the science on this is really clear. The priorities that it needs to be taken are really clear. And just to sort of frame this up, I like to sort of point this out about how obvious and not easy, but like straightforward the climate solutions are. This is the talking point I just want to share every time. Is this year BP put out, you know, a press release celebrating their new net zero ambition. At the same time, they put out another press release celebrating the fact that they were floating a $500 million oil drilling platform into the Gulf of Mexico to work on their $9 billion oil exploration program in the Gulf of Mexico, the Gulf they've already messed up once.
At the same time they were doing that, Joe Biden was putting forward a proposal to build 500,000 electric vehicle charging stations in the US. That cost $7.5 billion. And so for the same price that BP is using, or the same amount of money that BP is spending on drilling one single oil well in a Gulf that they already messed up once, they could otherwise choose to build the world's largest electric vehicle charging infrastructure network. And they chose the oil well. And so that's the decision that we're making here. And that's the kind of solutions that we could otherwise be investing in. And it's just really disappointing to see this continue. And so the solutions are really clear. The alternatives are really obvious and really achievable. And so, just bring it up. Like, keep raising your voice on this. And I think you'll find that you're not alone.
Yeah, absolutely. And do you think, and that's my last question, but do you think that similarly for activists or for people that are working or that are simply outraged by the influence that, you know, these companies can have, especially here in Brussels or in the EU more generally, do you think it's worth still calling out these links between these companies, these creative agencies, and the impact that that has on policy, as you were saying, more and more? So I'm guessing the answer will be yes, but still asking. And do you think there's enough transparency between kind of who is working for who and the impact that that has on the policies that are then adopted?
There's definitely not enough transparency. That is 100% obvious to me. It's very, you know, we've been running this campaign for about a year, and you can very steadily see portfolios of agencies and references to work with fossil fuel companies disappear off the internet in that year. So, it's getting harder and harder to uncover this stuff. And so I would say that's also the reason for individuals in the industry who are considered working in it to speak up and to make themselves heard. Because you actually have a window into this work that other people like me don't have. So there needs to be more transparency. And, you know, the oil industry is not long for this world. It is a dying industry, but the damage it can do is really extreme. And the amount of money they have to spend in that period of time is still really large. And so there's going to be someone who takes the money. I don't disagree with that. The problem is we need to make sure it's not the best people and that people who who want to use their creativity for good have an opportunity to do that. So yeah, just keep raising it. More is more.
Yeah, absolutely. And when it comes to transparency, I mean, when I was preparing this episode and when I was looking up the companies that had an office here in Brussels, it was so difficult and a lot of the time impossible to find a list of their clients. They were not transparent at all about who they were working for. And this is, of course, extremely problematic. But thank you so much for coming on the episode and explaining the mission of Clean Creative. It's an incredible initiative. I'm a big fan and I think it's so, so, so needed in the current context. So thank you for holding these organizations accountable. And I'm sure it's going to be of great interest for a lot of people who listen to the podcast. So thank you so much for coming. Have a lovely rest of the day. And yeah, let's keep up the good fight.
Thank you so much. It's really nice to talk with you about this.
Thank you everyone for tuning in and listening to this episode, which I hope was interesting to you. It definitely was for me because I have seen the names of these companies in Brussels so many times before, and I always knew they had a massive impact on the way policies were discussed and then adopted. But having this reminder from Duncan about their massive influence on the way the messages that, you know, touch the policymakers are crafted, it is really scary. And we talked about Edelman, but there's so many more. I mean, if you look up a website of, you know, creative agencies and public affairs consultancies here in Brussels, you know, there's Fleischmann Hille, there's FTI Consulting, there's Hanover, there's Hill and Knowlton, there is Weber Shandwick, Schumann Associates. There are dozens of them. And if we are really serious about, you know, developing policies that will have the impact that we need them to have, which is phasing out fossil fuel production and consumption, We need to start discussing about the impacts that the fossil fuel industry has on policymakers, but also the impact that they have via these companies and these consultancies that reach policymakers in a whole different way. Yeah, so I hope you enjoyed that episode. And as usual, you can let us know if you did, if you didn't, what would you like to hear about in our next episodes. And you can follow us also on our social media channel, which are the Burning Case Podcast. And I hope you're having a lovely rest of the day.